Live from New York, the 34th annual presentation of the American Theater Wing's Tony Awards, brought to you by the League of New York Theaters and Producers.
Hello, welcome back to My Little Tonys.
Hello, and we are back to the 80s.
Yeah, sort of. This is kind of our first around the horn season covering both the 70s and the 80s, the 1980 Tony Awards.
Yeah, you're right. It is.
I mean, it is technically an 80s ceremony.
But 79 to 80 season. I feel like this season, I had always been like, thank God that Evita and Sweeney Todd weren't up at the same year. But I actually, after covering this season, I feel confident that Sweeney Todd probably still would have swept.
I think so, too, because this was a really weak year other than Evita, and people were not too hot on Evita generally. The four best musicals were Evita with 11 nominations and 7 wins, Barnum with 10 nominations and 3 wins, Sugar Babies with 8 nominations and 0 wins, and A Day in Hollywood, A Night in the Ukraine, with 9 nominations and 2 wins. So this episode, we're just going to be talking about Evita and Barnum. It might be a little bit of a short episode. Oh, also, something, I didn't fact check this, but I think it is probably true that this is the last season where all four Best Musical nominees were profitable.
Oh, interesting. Well,
if we're wrong, don't tell us.
Yeah.
But I think, you know, it's interesting to look at Evita and Barnum together because they're both these portraits of these very controversial real-life figures, and they get very different treatments.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the other theme running through both of them, they're both very like, take my wife, please.
I also think that, yeah, it feels similar to 2008 in the way that out of the four best musical nominees, they separate kind of nicely into two different groups, where Evita and Barnum feel really in sync with one another, whereas Sugar Babies and A Day in Hollywood, A Night in the Ukraine, well, at least the first act of A Day in Hollywood and Sugar Babies feel kind of in tandem with one another.
Yeah, they're like these nostalgic reviews, not really, actually none of these shows are really super plot or like book driven. Evita has a lot of plot, but it doesn't really have a book.
Yeah, that's true. Or book in a traditional sense.
The other thing that I thought was interesting is that with the opening of Evita, that would mark the last time that there wasn't at least one Andrew Lloyd Webber show on Broadway at a time. This was the beginning of his domination.
Ah, yeah, I didn't consider that, but that makes perfect sense.
Yeah, like, you know, if the 70s are really Sondheim's decade, this is really literally like going straight from Sweeney Todd to Evita, really passing the torch over to the British mega musical. And there's some resistance from New York, the New York media, the New York Broadway world about sort of reading the tea leaves and seeing what's coming. But I think a lot of it is also wrapped up in the controversy about Evita herself.
Well, and I also think it's funny because while it feels really clear looking back at it now that we're at this kind of juncture moment where Andrew Lloyd Webber is about to take over, there is a piece kind of loosely about Barnum being like, the mini musical is hot this season. And it's like funny that history will say the opposite.
Yeah. Let's talk about the ceremony. It was a very strictly business. I think this is the first one that we've seen since our very first episode where like it was literally just performances from the nominated musicals. There was no kind of like extraneous bits or performance pieces, right? Because like 75 and 84 both had their own kind of thing going on.
Yeah, I guess even the opening number is just a number from Barnum.
I thought the way that the orchestra stings were under the credits were very ominous. Like, they were very scary.
Yes, yes.
And scenes from the four musical nominees. A Day in Hollywood, A Night in the Ukraine. Barnum. Evita. Sugar Babies. And special presentations from Oklahoma. Peter Pan. West Side Story.
But it was hosted by Mary Tyler Moore and Jason Robards Jr. I guess now he had dropped the junior.
So Mary Tyler Moore was hosting, and she won a Tony this year, a special Tony, because there was this play, Whose Life Is It Anyway?, which was about a sculptor who got paralyzed in a car crash. And the season before, it had already opened, and the lead man of it had won Best Actor, but they did like a stunt casting where they changed the sex sex of the male character and had the sculptor be a woman played by Mary Tyler Moore. And she won a special Tony citation.
Oh, so she was like a replacement?
Yeah, she was like a replacement. In an article about it, records don't specifically state why the Tony Administration Committee decided to give the actress a special Tony, a spokeswoman for the American Theater Wing said. But she did pass along the winner's list from that date, which noted that Moore's award was an appreciation of the appearance in live theater of a major television star. Which is funny because there are other op-eds after the Tonys that people were writing in and being like, I don't think that the Tonys are, you know, this like sentiment that we've been hearing all through the decades is, you know, like, I don't think that they're actually like awarding like people who deserve things. Like, I think they're just trying to like drum up sales where it's like kind of like, duh. That,
yeah. And there's also an article in the New York Times, like a Tony's recap, that calls the Tonys the Rolls Royce of televised awards shows.
Yeah. And yeah, and that article said that, like, out of all the award shows, the Tonys were the best.
Yeah, and they also say, because this was a little over a 90-minute show, and they're like, 90 minutes isn't enough. And they had to eliminate some awards, like, maybe think about bringing it up to 2 hours. And it's like, eventually it's going to become this bloated 3-hour spectacle. But it says there are two possible solutions, according to Mr. Cohen. Cut out more of the on-air awards or lengthen the broadcast to 2 hours. Given the Tonys' track record in terms of quality, it is not unreasonable to hope that the television network would decide to be generous.
And this is like a book, Curtain Times, the New York Theater, 1965 to 1987. And the author, Otis Guernsey Jr., gives a little introduction to the season. One of the New York Theater's specialties is embarrassing naysayers. Season after season, it teases them, like a bird doing a broken wing bit, into the most pessimistic pronouncements, and then confounds them by coming on strong, often in its apparently weakest mode. The season of 1979-80 was no exception. Is the star system only a memory? Mickey Rooney of Sugar Babies and Mary Tyler Moore of Whose Life Is It Anyways would be interested to hear it. Is the book musical disappearing from popular favor? Not so, as the potent revivals of West Side Story, Peter Pan, and Oklahoma would notice it. So I guess this is saying that, you know, the predictions were that this was kind of like, where was Broadway going? Would it survive? But I think that this was actually like a pretty traditionally successful season.
Yeah.
Which is of note because I think later in the 80s, things really dip.
Oh, yeah. Things are, you know, we've been talking about how to divvy up these 80s ceremonies, because the highs are high and the lows are very low.
Yeah, but there were 22 new plays, 13 musicals, 2 revues, 10 foreign plays translated into English, 11 revivals, and 8 specialty events. It was a big season.
Yeah, but, you know, ultimately, there wasn't really a lot to unseat Evita. And I think part of the reason why they didn't have those other performances is because the theme of this one was understudies, but it was like this very sort of half-assed, where they had the different presenters come out and like tell their understudy stories, but like by the end of it, everyone was sort of going off script and being like, I'm not gonna tell my story. Like, people were really going rogue at the end.
The producers asked us if we had understudy stories, but after all the funny ones, mine was so sad, involving oatmeal and urns and a Beckett play, that I didn't dare tell it. So I'm just going to read now the nominees for outstanding performance by a featured actor in a musical.
Carol Channing tells kind of like a shady story where she was understudying Eve Arden, and now she was like, and now Eve Arden like came and replaced me and Dolly. So it's very like, shoes on the other foot now, Eve Arden.
Yeah, I think that post our 1964 episode, I have been surprised, because I think Carol showed her true colors. And I also think that like we so rarely see her out of the Dolly character, that seeing how she interacts with other people in real life, I'm like, wow, she's secretly maybe a bitch.
But in a way that we love.
Yes.
She was doing her smile with her teeth that go all the way back to her ears. And also, they introduce her as being like, she just came off of the London production of Hello Dolly. So, you know, as we mentioned, she just continued to play Dolly forever. Anyway, Evita opened September 25th, 1979, closed June 26th, 1983, after 1,567 performances. Music by Andrew Lloyd Webber, book and lyrics by Tim Rice, directed by Harold Prince, choreographed by Larry Fuller. And the synopsis is, Andrew Lloyd Webber and Tim Rice's Evita charts the rags-to-riches rise of the First Lady of Argentina, who won the love of her countrymen after marrying military leader turned president Juan Perón. Set in Buenos Aires between 1934 and 1952, the musical follows Eva Duarte Perón on her journey from fatherless child to ambitious actress to the most powerful woman in Latin America, and eventually to a saint-like figure after her death from cancer at age 33. Do we want to talk about Eva, the real person, or the trajectory of the show first?
Maybe let's start by talking about Eva, the real person.
Okay, so I think I want to preface this by saying that neither of us are experts on mid-century Argentina and Argentinian politics. We've been doing our best.
It just, nothing adds up.
No, and a lot of the takeaway of it is other people being like, it's very confusing.
Mm-hmm.
So this is from Showstoppers talking about Don't Cry For Me, Argentina, which we will get into in a minute because I've had a tough time with this song this past week. The song's strange title did not originate with either Lloyd Webber or Tim Rice, who says it comes from Eva Perón's grave in La Recoleta Cemetery in Buenos Aires. One of her epitaphs, roughly translated, reads, "Don't cry for me, Argentina. I remain quite near to you." Evita was loved by the lower classes for her rise from poverty as an illegitimate child and possibly legit prostitute to radio star and actress. Yet she was despised by the wealthy, who considered her crass, crude, and Machiavellian, a conniving white trash tyrant, a Hispanic Lady Macbeth, not to mention a Nazi sympathizer. The columnist Joe Queenan definitely put it in a piece about the song in The Guardian. Eva was too politically unsophisticated to know the difference between a commie and a Nazi, as she was basically a lounge act. So I think this is a good jumping off point for the way that a lot of people talk about Eva Perón. And I think, like, the Nazi stuff aside, which obviously is not good,
mm-hmm.
and, you know, she and Perón provided refuge for a lot of Nazis as they were escaping after World War II, and Argentina was like a big Nazi haven. That's not good. But like the rest of the stuff in that, where it was like the wealthy didn't like her because she was, you know, trailer trash, like whatever. That's like, that's not that bad.
Yeah. I think that like someone kind of phrased it that like Peronism is like the bad parts of both fascism and socialism. And it's like, I don't know if that's necessarily true.
This is from that Guardian article, which I found very unnecessarily snarky, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
The Hugo Chavez of his time, Perón started out as the savior of the working class, much to the chagrin of aristocrats and privileged intellectuals, but then fell in with the wrong crowd and ended up becoming just another South American thug. Peronism, which continues to exist today, even despite Evita, is a rabble-rousing cult whose ideology is difficult to pin down because it is neither left nor right, neither fish nor fowl, but an eclectic mix of the worst elements of both. So again, I feel like there's a lot of racist, there's like both racist and sexist undertones with the way that people talk about Eva and Peronism. I'm not saying that they were not fascists, but I think like, especially this like she slept her way to the top thing,
mm-hmm.
that continues to come up over and over again, I feel like is this trope that really like scares a lot of straight men. And I think this is like a all straight male creative team. This fear of this, you know, incredibly like beautiful, charismatic woman who's just going to like manipulate you and discard you, that I think it, and it's like, what else was she going to do? You know, she was born into incredible poverty. She was like an illegitimate child. You know, how else is she going to escape her situation besides using the only things at her disposal, which was her looks and her charisma?
Mm-hmm.
Like, I don't think that's worth demonizing her for.
I also just think that the way that even Perón kind of came to power is like the male equivalent of like sleeping his way to the top. Like, he was just kind of, he was like part of this military insurgent group, and he was just kind of in the right place at the right time.
And even like the way that they staged it originally, there was like literally a revolving door on the stage showing Eva sleeping her way to the top. Like, that's mm-hmm. not really a nuanced view of a woman using her sexuality, which is really the only power that she had. I don't know. I'm always very wary of these stories that are like, she was just a bitch who got off on, you know, there was never enough power for her. And it's like, it's complicated because she is really still like so beloved by the poor in Argentina. Like, you know, I was mm-hmm. watching documentaries where they were like interviewing people now who are like, no one has ever done more for like the lower class of Argentina than Eva Perón. She was very pro-union. She was responsible for helping women get the right to vote in Argentina. She spent a lot of time like personally working with, you know, the poor and sick. So, you know, I think she's neither like this evil arch villain or a saint. It's really interesting and really super complicated.
Yeah. And there was like widespread outrage when a Madonna played her in the movie.
Yeah. And they were like, spray painting graffiti being like, Madonna, go home.
Yeah, and I think that kind of going off of that is that I found this article in Jacobin magazine, the famous socialist rag, and they kind of did a layout of Peronism like then and now.
Oh, good.
And I think that some of the interesting things that I took away from it is that they made the argument that while Peron had this like element of social justice with his ruling, it was kind of just in name rather than like actually caring. And like their kind of rise to power also came right at the end of the post-World War II boom. So there was just like a lot of money. And I think that it was easy for like the period of time that they were in power to have these leftist sentiments on top, but the actual seriousness of them, it was kind of just done to gain political gain rather than actually like changing the structure. Like Argentina was still like very much capitalist, and I think that they were kind of doing the bare minimum to make people think that they cared about them. But I think that even just saying acknowledging that these people are important and that they are cared for is, you know, more than a lot of other politicians would do.
It's true. And I think that's the attitude, not that it's important that they cared, the former element of it where it was just like paying lip service is kind of the attitude that the musical takes, the point of view. When it was coming to Broadway, people were comparing it to Springtime for Hitler in terms of glamorizing this like fascist figure.
It is just so interesting though, because no one can really put their finger on it. Like even like the article that I read didn't really answer all of the questions. They kind of end it with a Marx quote that they're like, well, this isn't actually about Eva Peron or Peronism, but like just kind of use your imagination.
The idea for the musical came from Tim Rice. He was like driving in his car one night listening to the radio, and he caught the end of a BBC program called Legends of Our Lifetime, and he caught the very end of it, and the announcer was like, and next time we're talking about James Dean. And Tim Rice was like, well, I like James Dean. Like, what's the Eva Peron done that makes her as interesting as James Dean?
So that he tuned in like the next couple of days to hear it, and then they actually had to go to BBC. And like, I didn't even know that you could do this, but it kind of makes sense. Like, they paid $20 or £20 to like sit in like a little room and like listen to the program.
It's pre-YouTube, pre-Google research. I have a quote from, there was a New York Times piece about how it was very controversial that it was coming to Broadway. All we're trying to do is tell her story, Mr. Rice adds. We think Evita is a fairly accurate portrait. Eva Peron was, in fact, a very glamorous and captivating person when she wanted to be. That was almost the only interesting thing about her. So to say we're glamorizing her simply isn't true. She was glamorous. What is their reply to those critics who suggest that, having musicalized the Perones, Rice and Lloyd Webber could as easily turn to the story of Eva Braun and Adolf Hitler? Such accusations are very distressing, Mr. Lloyd Webber said. We thought very deeply about doing this show, and we decided it was important that people see the dangers of a cynical and manipulative politician like Eva Peron, especially one so attractive, because an attractive extremist is so much more dangerous than an unattractive one. We feel very strongly that Evita is a cautionary tale. If you think musicals ought to be dealing with serious topics, as we do, then why can't Eva Peron be that topic? Asked Mr. Rice. Why do all musicals have to be about orphans and dogs and the like? Or cats?
Yeah, I know. When I read that, I was like, or cats?
Evita is written seriously about a serious topic. Gradually, in the writing of it, one came to grips with the fact that, fascinating as she was, Eva Peron was basically just another fascist dictator and finally a nasty piece of work. I think that comes through in the show. But then, I only wrote it.
I also think that that's like a little revisionist, because after reading the Andrew Lloyd Webber biography, and like, I don't think that in the UK it had the same problems with reception as it did in America.
I think everyone was pretty mad about the Nazi stuff in America.
Yeah. I mean, I totally get it, but it's like on the eve of electing Ronald Reagan as president. Never mind. But yeah, so Andrew Lloyd Webber, when they were first starting to kind of conceive of the show, he writes, Ava's death at such a young age, of course, gives the story a tragic twist. But because, at least for me, Ava had such ghastly values, I couldn't see how to make an audience care about her. More importantly, should I make an audience care? The more I thought, the more certain I was that I needed a device which allowed an audience to remain emotionally attached from Ava, whilst understanding why she captivated so many. It took me what seemed like ages to come up with a solution, but I vividly recall when and where I did. It was on a Saturday afternoon in Bristol at a particularly low point in the Jeeves saga. Jeeves was, he was writing a P.G. Wodehouse musical by Jeeves. I was humming a chorus of How Do You Solve a Problem Like Evita when I remember back in 1969, I saw one of the last ever concerts by Judy Garland at London's The Talk of the Town. Non-perform might be more accurate. Judy was an hour late on stage, and the dinner theater crowd, fueled by cheap house champagne, was restless, to put it mildly. Eventually, she stumbled on, made a stab at the trolley song, but was so blurred and incoherent the audience members threw coins on the stage. What happened next was unforgettable. She motioned to the musical director and he started playing Over the Rainbow. As she stumbled through her signature song, the booing and whistling grew louder and louder. Over the Rainbow, her anthem, the song which is indelibly Judy's and Judy's alone, was devouring her like a vulture on a battlefield. It was like seeing a frail little sparrow crushed in an iron fist. It was heartbreaking. I hope I'd never see such a spectacle again, but sadly I did 40 years later at a concert by the equally tragic and irreplaceable Amy Winehouse. If I could find an anthem for Ava and turn it on her like Over the Rainbow had turned on Judy, it would unlock her story musically. That afternoon, I wrote the slow tango melody of Don't Cry For Me, Argentina.
Whoa. I love that Andrew Lloyd Webber was an Amy Winehouse fan.
Yeah. But
interesting.
When they're like, she was a fascist, she was a dictator. Like, I think that that feels like such a different sentiment from like, she was like a Judy Garland, Amy Winehouse-esque tragic figure.
So they started to write this concept album, and Andrew Lloyd Webber said that he likes to do things as concept albums because it lets him develop it without any input from the director, which is very sneaky. But they sent it, I think it was still a work in progress, maybe they sent the demos to Hal Prince, mm-hmm. and he like gave them a bunch of notes, and he was like, I didn't expect to hear from those guys again, because they were like, thanks, we're still working on it. But his big suggestion was that they had, you know, this narrator Che, who Hal was like, I thought it was Che Guevara, but it turns out it was just supposed to be kind of like an everyman guy. Mm-hmm. And they picked the name Che because it's a very common Argentinian name. And so he was like, it needs to be Che Guevara. Otherwise, it's just going to confuse people and make them upset. So they made that change.
Yeah. I mean, there was some sort of drama where I think Hal was supposed to direct the original production of Jesus Christ Superstar, but like the telegram never came through.
Oh,
like,
really?
Over a bottle of wine, Hal quizzed me about musicals, how I had discovered them, what my ambitions were, and I told him my story. We didn't talk about Superstar. There wasn't much point.
And I think that the origins of it as a cast album ended up, or not as a cast album, as a concept album, led to this criticism, because the New York Times review, jumping ahead, was very mixed, and a lot of the criticisms they had with is that there was a lot of telling and not showing, like not a lot of stuff happens on stage, and it's mostly like people explaining what has happened or like what is about to happen, which I think is what happens when you are like, this is just going to be an album and we're telling the whole story through these lyrics. Walter Kerr said, the use of Che Guevara for the purpose seems to me approximately as opportunist as Evita's own manipulations, not because factually he wasn't there at the time, had nothing whatever to do with the Perones, but because he is most often employed to make certain that we won't go developing a crush on Evita ourselves. In effect, this keeps us permanently outside the action, unable to decipher Evita's complexities for ourselves. We ask ourselves in vain how this dubious and remote heroine managed to get close enough to Perón to work her will on him, what it was she did to endear herself to a gullible population. Because vital scenes are simply absent, there are no conclusions, no judgments we can arrive at on our own. They've all been handed down, hammered down from the outset. We're not participants, we're recipients of postal cards and photographs from all over, which is a chilly and left-handed way to write a character musical. Which, like, I kind of agree with. I think it's funny that they're like, you know, we try to give a fair depiction, like you can draw your own conclusions when you have, you do have Che like literally telling you what to think.
Mm-hmm. And I think kind of going off of that too, in this early concept album phase, someone had told Andrew Lloyd Webber that he was like, this would make a really good movie. And I think that like whenever he started to doubt himself, he would kind of be like, oh yeah, maybe this should just be a movie and not be a stage show. And I think that like with this criticism of like, it does a lot of describing and not a lot of showing on stage, I think that the movie kind of like helps alleviate that a little bit.
Because you can do like montages?
Exactly.
Yeah.
The last time I saw the Evita movie was actually pretty recently. It was probably just a few months ago. it was on in a hotel room, but they do a lot of montages and like are able to move through time and space in a way that I think Hal Prince's direction, he's kind of the master of bringing this like cinema sense to the stage in like a way that reads as stage, but has kind of like the vocabulary of cinema. But I think that Evita, it makes more sense to adapt Evita for film than like Hello Dolly.
I don't know if we've talked about this on the show, but Hal Prince, every time he's directing, he likes to start with like a central metaphor to kind of build on. And the metaphor for Evita was, it was a show about flashbulbs, microphones, and film, dramatizing how much the media can distort our vision of ordinary humans and create icons of them. People do give Hal Prince a lot of credit for being able to break down this concept album and make it into a coherent stage show. While we're on the subject of Hal Prince, this book, More Opening Nights on Broadway, which is, you know, a compilation of critics' reviews from different shows, but it also has like little essays about each show. Because we've talked a lot about, you know, the director choreographer, and this is about Hal Prince's kind of unique position as a director producer. Like Jesus Christ Superstar, Evita began its stage odyssey as a highly successful concept record album. But while The Nazareth Tuner was a collection of pop rock songs given a glossily theatrical production, in Evita, the songs themselves were highly theatricalized. Much credit for this goes to Harold Prince, whose editing and focusing powers had been keenly developed in a decade of Sondheim collaborations. The person in the director's chair had become an increasingly key force in the musical theater, at least in good musical theater. Robbins, Fosse, and Bennett all ruled and at times terrorized their writers in an effort to get what they wanted on the stage. The two Georges, Abbott and Kaufman, of the old school, formed and molded their songwriters' contributions too, but they were accomplished librettists as well as directors. Unlike the others, Prince was neither choreographer nor writer. His producing skills, though, proved an immense help in assembling and coordinating the work of the writers and the increasingly crucial design team. A strong directorial hand in itself doesn't guarantee success, as Prince himself demonstrated in his post-Evita string of ill-conceived ventures. Prince didn't write these, of course, but when dealing with concept musicals, the conceptor must be held accountable. Evita, though, was all to Prince's credit, his guidance transforming Lloyd Webber and Rice's not uninteresting song album into a dazzling stage entertainment. Thought that was a good little summary, because there's not that many. He's kind of one of a kind in that pedigree.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, totally. And I think that even moving into the future, like, we still see a lot of choreographer directors or a lot of directors who kind of make their bridge the two worlds.
Yeah, and I think I've mentioned before that, like, reading his book, he is much more, like, just the tone of his writing is much more matter of fact than the people who, like, are coming at it from another creative discipline. And it's like, he was a producer, you know, mm-hmm. He's like all about, you know, adding up the columns, but like, you know, obviously has this creative side, but he's a funny guy.
Yeah. I think that he really knows how to get it done. And like, I think that in comparing this to Phantom, like, I think that it had been described as like minimalist.
Yeah. Phantom?
No, this.
Oh, this. Yes. Yeah. Although it did make me very nervous in the Tony performance when they were carrying all those torches near those banners.
Yeah.
And he also, speaking of things being on fire, apparently there were like tons of bomb scares in theaters in the 70s. Both Hal and Patty in their books talk about multiple instances where they had a bomb scare and they were like, we're not going to stop the show. We're just going to keep going and hope nobody blows up.
That's
but
so crazy.
He also says it happened during Company and Pacific Overtures. So I think it was just something that was happening in the 70s. Everyone was like, well,
that also happened
in a bomb.
That also happened in my middle school.
Oh, no.
The early 2000s. So Yeesh. This Andrew Lloyd Webber book, I think, deserves its own episode. It's very strange. I think in the vein of Carol Channing's memoir, it's not doesn't seem to have been edited by someone.
So they had this concept album that was a big hit. Don't Cry for Me, Argentina was a hit already. And so when they were trying to cast the British version, there was like an interesting footnote where Hal Prince's frontrunner was this woman named Bonnie Shawn, who he had directed in Side by Sondheim, mm-hmm. but she lost out to Elaine Page, and then she lost out to Patty in the Broadway version, and she kind of is like faded away, like she was last seen in Jekyll and Hyde in 2001. So it's like kind of interesting, the people who are just one break away from making it, and it's like, you know, some people just get the bad breaks.
Yeah.
So Bonnie, if you're out there, I'm sorry.
Yeah, and Julie Covington, who I guess was like a respected British singer, was on the concept album, and when they went to be like, well, we actually want to stage this, she was like, there is no way that you're going to make me sing that score 8 times a day.
Eight times a day?
I mean, eight times a week.
Eight times a day would be way too many. Eight times a week is still too many. And as for fortune and as for fame, I never invited them in. Though it seemed to the world they were all I desired. Yeah, when Patty heard the score, she was like, she was also not excited because she was like, whoever wrote this hates women. Most of it sits in the passaggio, which is the break between your chest voice and your head voice, which is like not a range that most people have a lot of power in. And she talks a lot about how she just like shredded her voice during the run. And she had, there was like an ensemble member who was giving her voice lessons to like make sure she made it through. I don't know, but it's like she sounds amazing in everything. She sounds amazing on the cast album. She sounds amazing in every like television performance, including this Tony's performance.
Mm-hmm.
But she's always talking about how she like, you know, she like lost her voice entirely, literally the first day in LA. The sad thing is like the score really only sounds good if you're just like belting your face off the whole time. Like, there have been Evitas since then where it's like, you know, they're singing in these little, like, this little thin head voice. And it's like, that's not fun. That's not what I'm here for.
Yeah. I think that this is a show that it's like, it's all about the star quality of your Evita.
Just a little touch of star quality. Star quality is the only note in that that's in my range. Just a little touch of, just a little touch of Argentina's brand of star quality. It's kind of in line with Evita, you know, like burning brightly for a short time, like in her life, you know, dying at 33. It's like, you just got to sing your head off, blow your voice out just for this show. And it's like, live fast, die young, except yeah. About your voice.
I found a little piece about, I was skeptical whether Andrew Lloyd Webber would mention Patty at all in this book. And, you know, for those of you not in the know, this book came out, like, in 2018, so it's very recent. But I guess they had made up since then. This is, imagine a British person saying it, because it'll make sense. Not, I suspect, for the last time in this tome, I am going to claim a senior moment. I have absolutely no clue when or from whom I first heard the name Patty LuPone. I remember being asked to listen to a recording of her singing a song called Meadowlark by Stephen Schwartz, from his hapless musical, The Baker's Wife. Well, I know I've got to go fly away, and along, fly away in the silver morning. If I stay, I'll grow to curse the dark. So it's off when the days don't find me. I know I leave wounds behind me, but I won't let tomorrow find me. Back this way before my past once again can blind me. Three things struck me. First, the song was brilliant. This was hardly surprising, as Stephen was the composer, lyricist of Godspell and Pippin. This latter musical had been produced in London by Stigwood, and unlike on Broadway, flopped, though no fault of Schwartz. Some blamed its director, Bob Fosse, who failed to turn up at the press conference, telling its publicist, my friend Anthony Paggiri, that he was shagging Liza Minnelli in the Savoy and would be until further notice. The second was that Patty definitely seemed to have the chops. Meadowlark is a showpiece, tour de force for a woman. Her performance suggested my score was well in her range. The third was that she must have had a stinking cold when she recorded it, or had a bad problem with adenoids, which I presumed was a temporary issue.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, he's got to mention her. Although there was a BBC documentary about Evita that came out last year about the musical. Did not mention Patty or Mandy one time. It just went straight from Elaine Page to Madonna.
That's so interesting, especially because I think that, you know, even they had Colm Wilkinson. He was like on the concept album and he has a beautiful voice and has been thrown into his own star orbit, mm-hmm. via Les Mis. Well, and he and Patty were both in the original London Les Mis.
Yeah.
But they were like, yeah, he didn't do. Like, it seemed like it was such a problem to cast it that I'm surprised that they don't give the people their due diligence.
Yeah, and at this point, Patty was really thought of as a non-singing actor. Like, The Baker's Wife was really, I believe, her first starring role in a musical, and it didn't make it to Broadway. It closed out of town. But before they found Elaine Page, Hal Prince was toying with the idea of having there be three Avas, you know, Cher show style, which I think would have really cut down on the vocal load for the leading lady, and maybe they should have done that. Because yeah. she, you know, it starts with her at 15, it goes from 15 to 33.
It definitely would have cut down on the wig budget.
Yeah. No, you'd have to have even more wigs.
Even more wigs,
everyone's
got
to have their own wig. Just quickly going back to Madonna doing it. And we're not going to talk about the movie too much, except that it was like the only really major movie musical of the 90s. And before Madonna was cast, some of the other names that were thrown around were Barbara and Meryl. Uh-huh. I think Meryl came pretty close. But in the Al Hirschfeld book, he has, like, next to his caricature of Patty and Evita, he writes, "I've heard someone recently made a movie of Evita with Madonna in the title role. Is that true or just a joke?" Which I think is just the perfect encapsulation of how a lot of people feel about it.
Yeah, and also there is a very funny French and Saunders interview that had been, like, translated from, like, Czech to English. It was, like, the Czech or, like, Polish media doing an interview with Madonna, but the people doing the interviewing, I mean the translating, were, like, translating everything completely crazy, and it's definitely worth a listen.
"May we talk about your other baby, your movie, then? Mm-hmm. Please do not be denying that the similarities between you and the real Evita are grounded in basis. Mm-hmm. Power, money, tasty food, Grammys, all these elements are afoot."
What is up in the air with you? Evita never was winning a Grammy.
So Patty had really, she, like, only has bad things to say about her experience in Evita, basically. She's like, "I didn't like the music, you know, my voice was a wreck. I didn't really like working with Hal Prince." And apparently the alternate was really, like, nipping at her heels. Patty had, like, a diva reputation, mostly because they were like, "Well, Elaine Page did it this way." And she was like, "Fuck Elaine Page."
Which I think is the right response to that question.
But apparently, like, the chorus all hated her. And, like, downstairs in the chorus dressing rooms, they put, like, Patty's bad reviews up on the wall next to the alternate's good reviews.
Yikes. That sucks. I think my theory on this is, which is no, is just me reading the text, but I think it also has to do with the fact that, like, there aren't really any secondary parts in the show besides Perone's mistress, who has, like, a beautiful haunting one song.
That's
but
true.
Like,
it sounds like a Judy Collins song. Yeah. Especially the woman singing it on the Broadway cast album.
"So what about now? Another suitcase in another so what about now? Take your picture off another wall.
Where am I going?
You'll get by, you always have before.
Where going to?"
Well, what's interesting was that, as I might have mentioned earlier, Andrew Lloyd Webber had this P.G. Wodehouse Jeeves musical that flopped that he later reworked and is actually quite a treat to listen to. I guess Tim Rice told him to, like, put the score in the vault and, like, wait, but, like, one of the worst songs in it was, like, a song about tennis, and that is what became Another Suitcase, Another Hall.
Really?
Yes.
Wow, that would be a really sad song about tennis.
Yeah.
Very melancholy. So Patty came very close to being fired in LA. And I think she says that, you know, when she would come out as Ava, like, for the curtain call, the applause would dip after Mandy because everyone hated the character so much. And even when she wins the Tony, you can hear people booing her in the audience. Like, there are audible boos.
Yeah.
And you don't know if it's for, you know, whatever diva reputation she has, whether people are just, like, mad about the musical. And she said that afterwards, it didn't really boost her career at all. Like, she was basically offered Lady Macbeth, and that was it.
Poor Patty.
I know. It's okay. She came out on top at the end.
Yeah, she really did. I wonder if the reason why the show has been, like, why it's so well remembered is, one, I think has to do with Andrew Lloyd Webber, and two, I wonder if the movie helped to, like, boost its profile in history.
Well, and I think also, like, in Hal Prince's speech, he references that there are already, like, five companies of Evita running or, like, about to open.
"And let me especially congratulate and send my love and my gratitude again to the Evita Company in New York, the one in London, the one in Los Angeles, the one we just completed casting for Chicago last week, and the one that I directed in Adelaide, Australia." last month.
So they were really like spreading that show like wildfire, even while the original cast was like not even that old.
That's interesting.
It was running in England still. Like, it ran in England for 9 years.
Wow.
Yeah, so it was running there. They had a Broadway one. They opened the LA one, mm-hmm. like, pretty soon afterwards.
And I guess also, like, you know, the success of the concept album and also Jesus Christ Superstar.
It's really smart. It's a smart way. I mean, the two ways to make sure people think of your score as hummable are, one, you know, to release the songs beforehand so everyone knows them, and two, to repeat the melodies constantly so everyone gets really familiar with them. And
which he did both.
Exactly. Avita definitely does both of those things.
It's funny because it's like someone like Julie Stein, I feel like he, in, you know, the research we've done about him, like, he definitely had like pop stars record his songs and like release them before the show, like as the shows were opening or before they even opened. Mm-hmm. But it like feels so different to like make a concept album.
Yeah.
But it's cool.
So now I think it's time to talk about Don't Cry For Me, Argentina, which is, you know, the show's big calling card. So it was a hit even before the musical was a musical.
And something funny about that I read in the Andrew Lloyd Webber book is that it like rose to the top of the disco charts in the UK, and they figured out the reason why was because they would play it at the end of the night when the party was over, and it would like clear everyone out.
There was at least one disco cover by Tom Jones.
Don't cry for me, Argentina. The truth is I never left you. All through my wild days, my mad existence, I kept my promise. Don't keep your distance.
But it's also been covered by people as wide-ranging as Olivia Newton-John, The Carpenters, Sinead O'Connor, Shirley Bassey, Nicole Scherzinger, and Il Divo.
Oh, my God.
So I've had quite the journey with this song over the last couple of days because I had never listened to Avita beyond the highlights, and I think after this I will also go back to only listening to the highlights. But I was like, I don't really understand what is happening in Don't Cry For Me, Argentina, but I'm sure once I hear it in context, it'll all make sense. And it doesn't. First of all, it's in a completely different spot than I expected it to be based on the lyrics. Like, I thought it was kind of her final goodbye, like when she was dying, or like maybe she got deposed or something. And it does serve as that. They use it in the beginning, mm-hmm. as like her talking from beyond the grave, and then and as part of her like final broadcast, yeah. right? So like it makes sense in both those places, but like the main place it is as her victory speech, which is like, why would they be crying for her? That's like the height of her power. And like, so part of that journey is that I learned that nobody knows what it means, including Patti LuPone
and Tim Rice and Andrew Lloyd Webber.
So this is in Showstoppers. As sung by Julie Covington in 1977, the tune sold nearly a million copies and became a major marketing tool for the 1978 musical that had people lining up outside the Prince Edward Theater just to hear Paige deliver it on stage, even if audiences were stymied about what it actually meant. Lyricist Tim Rice concedes, "The song in itself almost doesn't make sense. It's meant to be a string of political cliches, sounding pretty and not really saying very much. But it kind of worked, bizarrely. Director Greg McKellen clears up the confusion. It took me the longest time to understand what that song was about. She's not saying don't cry tears for me. She's saying don't cry out for me. Don't call for me because I'm here. I never left you. I got that interpretation from a friend of Tim Rice's." So, like, I think that's kind of like a retroactively trying to make it make sense. And there's a funny Patti quote. So this is an interview with Patti. And the interviewer says, "Did you comprehend the lyrics at first?" And she said, "It didn't make any sense to me, even inside the show. Why is she saying don't cry for me, Argentina? I never left you. I didn't get it. Where does don't cry come in? Because they're not crying. They're shouting, Avita, Avita, Avita." There was never anybody on stage going, "Boo-hoo, she left us." It took a long time for me to figure it out. It's a manipulation. After she sings the first verse, I didn't know what she was trying to accomplish, what was going on. The lyric is a little vague.
Well, and I think that this happens a lot, where the creative team's like trying to find an end to the show, and they're like, "Oh, well, we wrote this song and this is it. This is like the song," especially like a song that like kind of becomes a crossover pop hit. But I think in like such an integrated musical, like, it doesn't read.
I felt very betrayed by this, even though I should have known better than to trust those two,
yeah.
to lead me somewhere coherent.
I feel like the Washington Post reviewer gets, like, sums up everything we've been saying pretty nicely. He noted, "As Ava, Patti LuPone must deal with the shallowness of both the character and the authors. It is a losing battle, And since her singing is so hard to understand in certain registers, I presume he meant diction, her performance comes across perhaps unfairly as one of Evita's serious drawbacks. He did, however, praise her version of Don't Cry for Me, Argentina. And Andrew Lloyd Webber says, I had three worries about Patty. She wasn't caressing and seducing the audience in Don't Cry for Me, Argentina like Elaine did. She did also had a tendency to bend the timing of musical phrases. Finally, there was her diction. Muttering began about her in Broadway.
Well, she was almost fired in L.A. and replaced by Elaine Page. Just going back to the lyric itself, like, I think the line, Don't Cry for Me, Argentina, has become sort of the one thing that everybody knows about the show. But, like, I think it's been proven time and time again that musicals don't have to make sense in order for them to work on an overall level. Mm-hmm. But I think if they were trying to do this thing where it's, like, it's foreshadowed at the beginning, they call back to it at the end, and then it has the spot in the middle, I feel like the lyrics would have to be different, ideally, in that middle spot to reflect, like, a more kind of victorious... I think they were just being lazy to be like, we can just have the same lyrics over and over.
Yeah.
You know, like, you should have been like, hey, it's me, your best friend, Evita, you know?
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah, I feel like the same, you could have kept the same music, but just, like, made the lyrics.
Yeah, exactly.
Makes sense.
And they
especially because they don't really rhyme either.
Nope. And they have chasing it in Oh What a Circus, which also became a hit on its own. It's like, you just keep recycling the same tune. But it's working. It worked for them. You know, what do I know? I haven't had any successful musicals. But yeah, it's really been a journey for me these past few days to accept that Don't Cry for Me, Argentina is actually just gibberish and does not really have anything to do with what's happening in the show.
Yeah, apparently, you know, in that letter he says, my main feeling is that it's terribly important to concentrate now on the actual singing of the material. I know Hal has spoken to you about Don't Cry for Me, Argentina. The main point of that song is that it should be sweet and seductive. I am quite sure that if you work on the delivery of the songs, the whole thing will fit into place astonishingly quickly.
That's so rude. It's like,
I know.
Hey,
it's also like you wrote this bad musical.
Also, like a musical that's all sung through. It's like, have you considered thinking about how you're singing it?
I wonder. I'm sure that this is probably one of those shows that gets performed at opera, like in opera seasons.
I think it is. And there was a little quote because it was about to be put up somewhere. And Andrew Lloyd Webber, I think all music is the same. There's only good music and bad music.
Oh, yeah. I saw that quote.
Yeah, that was about the difference between theater and opera. But I don't think it would be interesting sung by operatic voices.
No, not at all.
You gotta have belting.
Yeah, especially, 100%. Also, on the note of opera, he at first was like, I don't want to have it have any sort of Argentine flair to it. And he was like, when Puccini wrote La Boheme, like, no one made him, like, incorporate, like, the sounds of Bohemia into it. And it's like, that was a long time ago.
Yeah.
And then it's like, when he got into it, he had, you know, accepted the Argentine flair.
It seems like really against the odds that this show about a political figure who's mostly unknown in the U.S., with so much, like, politics involved in the plot, ended up being so successful. Like, I think, you know, the Cinderella story aspect, like, the dying tragically young, like, that is really, you know, what ends up carrying it through all of these, like, political machinations. And also part of the reason Hal Prince wanted them to change Che to Che Guevara is he was like, people in the U.S. don't know who Eva Perón is, but they know who Che is. So that'll be like a way, you know, it'll be like a little bit less intimidating.
That's so funny.
Yeah.
Also, the funny thing that we both noted was that, like, the original Che, like, had this subplot where he was trying to get a patent for insecticides.
Yeah, and Hal Prince is like, that is a really weird red herring, and it's just going to distract people.
And if you listen to the concept recording, there is at least one mention. He's like, but my insecticides.
In the musical, they reference the Descamisados, which were Evita's impoverished followers, which means the shirtless ones. And the fans of Evita the show started calling themselves the Descamisados, which is a little problematic to me.
Yeah.
Like, you guys are Broadway fans. You're not the impoverished of Argentina.
That's very funny. And I guess, like, it's interesting because it didn't get great reviews pretty across the board. Andrew Lloyd Webber, I'm not going to read the passage because it is incredibly drawn out like everything else I've read from this book. Oh, the one amazing thing is that he calls out Walter Kerr's review, which we both read, where he describes that Patty's having a rattlesnake vitality.
Oh, yeah.
Leering tongue, her firmly set jaw, and the ice water that plainly runs in her veins.
I know that he did, but they did not like Patty.
He was like saying that a lot of critics didn't want to be on the wrong side of things. One of the worst reviews was John Simon's in New York Magazine. Stench is a stench on any scale, he wrote in a review, which was unequivocal in implying that we're glorifying fascism. What sort of chaps are these authors who can exalt with equal enthusiasm Jesus Christ and Eva Perón? The two had nothing in common except that they both died at 33. To Rice and Weber, they seemed equally suitable for enshrinement. If you want to fill the coffers of these two immoral, barely talented whippersnappers and their knowing or duped accomplices, by all means see this artfully produced monument to human indecency.
Jesus. And it's funny because the book that they used as the basis for it, The Woman with the Whip, has in retrospect been criticized as sort of being unfair to Eva and like being overly critical of her. So people were just not having it at all.
But Andrew Lloyd Webber says Broadway folklore has it that it was the producer who turned Evita around with the first ever TV advertising campaign for a musical.
That's not true.
Really?
Y'all ever heard of The Wiz?
Oh, yeah, duh.
So the commercial is directed by Bob Giraldi, who was a music video director, and he directed Love is a Battlefield by Pat Benatar and Beat It by Michael Jackson. So we're going to post that on our Instagram, so take a look if you haven't seen it. It's really weird.
I guess getting to the Tonys, this is by far out of anything that's performed this night. I would say there's only one close second performance, and it's the West Side Story performance.
Yeah.
But everything else is like, it feels like, I know that everyone was into the nostalgia factor this season, but this performance, like, everything looks so stupid in comparison.
Yeah, I have to say though, Patty's wig looks like, I know it's like accurate, but have you seen the Francis Ford Coppola Dracula movie?
Yes.
It looks a lot like the wig that Gary Oldman is sporting in that movie.
Oh my God.
Yeah, but I mean, Patty sounds amazing, belting out those high notes. Madonna wishes. It really sells you on everything that you would want to buy when you're going to see Evita.
I think Mandy's pretty absent from this Andrew Lloyd Webber book.
You know, it seems like Mandy just kind of, like, Patty was the source of so much drama. Like, Mandy was just kind of keeping his head down and doing it. I guess we should call out, if you haven't seen the Seth Rudetsky deconstruction.
Oh, of course, yes.
There's the iconic moment where Patty tries to loop her arm through Perón and misses. Keep an eye out for that. I'm trying to, what other bits and pieces? I think it's worth mentioning that, one, Patty says she was visited by the ghost of Eva during the rehearsal process that told her everything was going to be okay. And the sort of saga of Evita, the real Evita, is that after she died, her body disappeared for 17 years and nobody knew where it was. I think I read that they had her real body and then they had a bunch of like fake coffins that were filled with dirt and they like sent them to all these different places in the world because they didn't want the Peronists to, you know, like dig her up and whatever.
Yeah, and after her death, Perón himself kind of had like a very short run. Like he married someone new and like I think he died and then she was sent to exile.
Yeah. Oh no, he was run out.
Oh, he was run out.
He was overthrown and went to live somewhere else.
My other two notes that I haven't mentioned was this was Hal's 14th Tony.
Already?
Yeah, he was already had the record at this point, and I think this was just like a feather. He was like, and he still is in the lead.
Yeah, I don't think anyone is ever gonna overturn him.
No.
That's what you get for being the producer director.
Yeah. Many, many Tonys.
Yeah.
And the other thing is that the style of a dress for Andrew Lloyd Webber is the Right Honorable the Lord Lloyd Webber.
Sure.
Yes.
I hate that. So, let's talk about Barnum. Oh, I also just want to mention, while we're on the subject of Patty, and since we didn't talk about it last time, I am obsessed with the big diva energy that it takes for her. When her memoir came out, she like held a, you know, nationwide contest to name it. And the submission that she went with was Patty LuPone, a memoir. But she also published like the runners up, one of which was Mein Kampf.
Oh.
So, you know, Patty,
she's a Sicilian girl with a sense of humor. Yeah.
Giving us what we want every day of the week and twice on Sundays.
So next up, we have the other big musical of the year, Barnum, which opened on April 30th, 1980 and closed May 16th, 1982 after 854 performances. You have a book by Mark Bramble, music by Cy Coleman and lyrics by Michael Stewart, directed and musically staged by Joe Layton. And the synopsis is, welcome to the greatest show on earth, the world of Phineas Taylor Barnum, full of spectacle and humbug. Sometimes with her support and sometimes against her objections, P.T. Barnum works with his wife Charity to create unbelievable attractions in a variety of ways, from the American Museum in New York City to a national tour featuring Jenny Lind, the Swedish Nightingale. Along the way, Barnum meets Joyce Heth, the oldest woman alive, and Tom Thumb, the smallest man in the world. He dabbles in politics and begins a lecture tour, culminating in his founding of the greatest show on earth with partner James Bailey. Nominated for 10 Tony Awards and winning 3, Barnum is a joyful ride of humbug and laughter for audiences of all ages.
So I think, you know, the main appeal of this one is that it was staged as a circus. It kind of has like Pippin slash Chicago even kind of vibes, where it's like, you know, everything in it is kind of a circus act.
Yeah.
And then it also had Jim Dale, who wins best leading actor. He was really giving like a star-making performance. He walked on a tightrope. He like jumped around on trampolines.
There's a recording of Michael Crawford turn in the show in London that was like made into a produced like TV movie event thing. But when he's on the tightrope, I am like, ah!
Yeah, it's a lot to ask. It's not, you know, the high belting of Evita, but it's its own thing. So I think I want to address the elephant in the room, which is neither of us have seen The Greatest Showman. You haven't seen it, right? No.
No.
But I think we both kind of have a general awareness of what it is like based on just cultural osmosis. Mm-hmm. And I think this show, you know, it's interesting because P.T. Barnum is really like such an unsavory character, but we really want to elevate him to this. I don't know. It's like, neither of us saw Jim Dale, but I think in the Michael Crawford performance, there's a lot of like ain't I a stinker energy in it. Whereas I feel like my impression of the Hugh Jackman version is he's like even more cuddly.
Yeah.
But I want to talk about Joyce Heth, because Joyce Heth does not appear in The Greatest Showman. She does appear in this musical, and I don't know what's worse, like having her not there at all or having her in the cutesy way they have her here. Joyce Heth was, I'm just going to read an excerpt from this article that I found kind of summing it up. Barnum first made a name for himself by selling tickets to see Joyce Heth, an enslaved woman, and when she died, he sold tickets to her autopsy too. She was the source of the original act that made Barnum famous and set him on a track towards his career in show business, says Benjamin Rice, author of The Showman and the Slave. She was also, for a time in the 1830s, one of the most famous people, arguably, in America. One of the first real media celebrities of American culture. On the road, Heth was on public display for up to 12 hours a day, 6 days a week. White ticket buyers would come to listen to her recount stories about Washington. So he was saying that she was like George Washington's nursemaid and she was like 160 years old, whatever. They could take her pulse, touch her, shake hands with her, Rice says. So she was almost treated not just like an animal in a zoo in some ways, but like an animal in a petting zoo. And yet at the same time, she was advertised as this great national historical treasure, the last living link, or one of the last living links to George Washington. Although she was traveling in the North, Heth was still legally enslaved to a slaveholder in Kentucky, and Barnum had paid $1,000 to take her on tour for 12 months. She made no money from the tour, and there was no agreement that she or any of her family would earn freedom. Yet for Barnum, these lies were part of the business. Throughout his career, he deliberately told fabricated, contradictory stories about himself and the people in his show to drum up public interest. In another instance, Barnum planted a story in a Boston newspaper claiming that Heth was a hoax. She wasn't actually a 161-year-old woman, he said. She was an automaton, or machine, made of whalebone and leather. By the time she met Barnum in 1835, she was not 161 years old, but she was an old woman, Rice says. She was dying throughout the entire time of her tour. She had evidently had a major stroke. She was blind. She was very frail and feeble. And another source says that she was toothless because Barnum physically had her teeth removed. She died February 1836, just months after becoming part of Barnum's show. But unbeknownst to her, she was still the main attraction. Barnum sold tickets to her autopsy, which a surgeon performed in front of some 1,500 onlookers, according to Harriet A. Washington's book, Medical Apartheid. That surgeon concluded that Heth couldn't be more than 80, which prompted Barnum to declare that her death had been a hoax. This time, he said he'd given the surgeon a different body, that Heth was alive and well, and that she would one day return to the spotlight. So it's really, they have her portrayed in the show as in a very kind of like cutesy way where she's like sort of in on it, and that was not the reality at all.
But like, it's cutesy, but it's also like very bad stereotype.
Yeah. Oh, yes. Yeah. Yes, very much. But it's like, it doesn't capture sort of the reality of the horror of the situation.
She's and just it, like, I don't know anyone named Washington.
Yeah.
It's like, ugh.
And I think it's like back in the 80s where I think like people maybe didn't think twice about including that in there. Whereas like now, when you're making a story of his life, it's like, well, you cannot have that in there because people are going to be upset. But it's like, it's the reality of what happened. It's how he made his money and his name was, you know, exploiting this old dying slave woman.
It's worth noting that, like, at the time, this was, like, so warmly received. And people were like, it's great. It's Americana. Yeah. And it's like, Evita's evil. And now, like, I don't even think that, I guess there was a London revival a few years ago, but I don't think that you could have this.
No, I don't think either. I think this is dead.
Yeah.
Dead in the water. Just briefly, the origin of this is that this was actually a David Merrick. He optioned the story. He put together the creative team. They wrote it. And then he was like, I'm going to do 42nd Street. And he just dropped it. And then other producers picked it up, including Cy Coleman, the composer. So it was very much like, we already did this thing. We got to get it on stage.
Yeah. And what was interesting was that, I guess, in 1963, someone had, like, taken out, like, a huge billboard being, like, come see Barnum, the musical. But that was, like, no one associated with that project ended up being associated with this. And it was just kind of, like, they had gotten, like, the billboard space, but, like, it never actually came to fruition.
Oh, weird.
Yeah.
So Glenn Close is in the original production. She was in the extremely thankless role of his wife, who is... such a wet blanket. You can't win as a wife. Like, either you are ruthlessly ambitious and just dragging your husband along, or, you know, you're crushing his ambition by being a prim little school teacher or whatever. Not a great season for roles for women.
No.
I mean, Evita is a great role for a woman, but it's complicated.
But Glenn, she's great.
She is great. And she did get nominated for a Tony. I mean, I also love Jim Dale because my family, we would listen to the Harry Potter audiobooks on all of our road trips constantly. So he really is the voice of my childhood. So it's nice to see this like star-making performance from him and kind of see his origins. He's very charming. I just don't understand why people are so resistant to, I mean, I do understand, but like, I think a story of the real P.T. Barnum and like the totally like fucked up guy he was would be a lot more interesting than these versions of him that we've been getting in Barnum and The Greatest Showman.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know why we're so resistant. Again, I do know why. I do and I don't know why. Like, it seems like he wouldn't be someone that we would put up on such a pedestal that it's like the circus cannot possibly be knocked down to show us the reality of the situation and like the things that he did to get ahead the way that Evita did.
Yeah. And well, and I also think that like what one of the big pieces missing from this is that Joyce Heth and like Jenny Lind were like Kardashian level, you know, like I think that in a culture that's so obsessed about celebrity, it's curious to me that no one is like kind of telling this tale of the precursors to like our modern day Marilyn Monroe's to Judy Garland's to, you know.
Yeah, although Joyce Heth and Jenny Lind are at opposite ends of the spectrum in terms of what people are interested in and, you know, what kind of agency they had over their performance, I guess.
Yeah, totally.
But I mean, that would be like a really interesting angle for a movie if they weren't trying to just like gloss over it and be like, he, you know, brought a voice to people that society was ignoring. It's like, that's not what he was doing.
No. I've only seen clips of Greatest Showman on, like, TV in passing, and I feel like it really got the Moulin Rouge treatment.
And it is not an inspirational story in any way, except, you know, making a lot of money as a person in show business is inspirational, I guess. I mean, as a spectacle, it was like, you know, cool and entertaining and whatever.
Another interesting thing is that Jim Dale had injured himself in like a Molière play like the season earlier. And he's like, every time I'm on that tightrope, me breaking my ankle flashes before my face. And
that's
like,
so funny that he would follow that up with such a scary and demanding role.
I guess like drawing the comparison between it and Evita, I think that like a lot of people's criticisms of Evita was that like it told you and it didn't show you. Mm-hmm. Whereas like I think that this did a lot of showing, but it still even felt like not satisfactory.
Yeah, it's very style over substance. And I didn't fully understand, and maybe I wasn't paying enough attention. I didn't really understand the stuff that was going on with his like political career in Act Two, but I don't think it matters.
Yeah.
Maybe they'll cover that in The Greatest Showman Part Two, which is coming.
Oh, really?
Yes. But I did like, so they got to perform twice. They performed Come Follow the Band as, I guess, like the Tony opening number.
Come follow the band, wherever it's at.
And then Jim Dale later does, there's a Sucker Born Every Minute, yeah, or whatever it's called.
Barnum's the name! P.T. Barnum! And I want to tell you that tonight on this stage you are going to see Barnum, every sight, wonder, and humbug that name stands for, including Jumbo, the largest elephant in the world, the amazing great white whale from Labrador, Tom Thumb, only 25 inches from toe to crown, Joyce Heth, the oldest woman in the world, the amazing, the wonderful, floating nightingale from Sweden, and if you're willing to put up with all this humbug, you are going to see a sight that's really wonderful. Let me tell you, folks, stop the music. This is what I'm going to tell you. One, two, three, four. There is a sucker born every minute. Each time that second hand sweeps through the top like dandelions. Up they pop their ears so big, their eyes so wide, and oh, I feed them bona fide baloney with no truth in it. Why, you can bet I'll find some room to buy my corn. Cause there's a sure shooting sucker born a minute. And I'm referring to the minute you was born.
Both of those are fun. You know, I like Cy Coleman.
And as far as like heartstringy songs, I love The Color of My Life, which was like kind of like a twin soliloquy. Mm-hmm. And also in Act Two, there's a song Black and White that I thought was a banger.
Yeah. You know, it's not a bad score at all. It's too bad it's got so much baggage.
Yeah.
Ain't no man who can resist me, wait and see. Cause there's a sure a shooting sucker born a minute. And friends, the biggest one, excluding none, is me.
Okay, I think that's it.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. Don't cry for us. You can cry out for us on Twitter and Instagram. At My Little Tonys. You can email us at mylittletoniespodcast@gmail.com. And next time we're going to talk about Sugar Babies, A Day in Hollywood, A Night in the Ukraine, The Three Revivals.
Yes.
Sounds good.
Okay.
Okay. We'll see you there.
Bye.
Bye.